Their pace was slower than Panev would have liked. He preferred to get the hike done quickly, especially when it was hot, as today was certainly going to be. The sky was gray now, but the tops of the dusty brown hills surrounding the path were just starting to glow. If they hurried, the sun would just be burning its way into the Egyptian sky by the time they reached the valley. When it really started to bake, they would be deep in the limestone, ensconced in the cool of the tomb. Panev glanced back. His father was just turning the corner, his pace steady but pained. His knees were bothering him today, Panev could tell. The old man tried not to let anyone see, but the pain did slow him down, especially with a bundle of copper tools on his back. Wordlessly, Panev relieved him of the load. It was heavy, heavier than he remembered. Panev was a stonemason now, more skilled and better paid than his father. He hadn't carried a bundle like that in a few years. There was shame in his father's eyes. He couldn't keep doing this for much longer, Panev thought, carefully placing one foot in front of the other on the packed dirt of the path. But his father hated to be at home, where idleness ate away at him. Conversing with his various cousins, his second wife's family, and that idiot scribe next door drove him mad. Panev's father loved nothing more than the walk to the valley, humming a wordless tune while he trudged steadily onward with his burden. He took pride in his work, building the great tombs in which their kings would eventually be laid to rest. Every basket of limestone rubble was handled with the utmost care. Every swing of the mallet or push on the lever done with the intention and precision of a painter with his brush. Panev's stomach lurched as he felt his foot slip on a loose rock. It hadn't been there 2 days ago. Panev knew this path like the back of his hand. The stone must have washed down the hill during a recent rainfall. Knowing this did him no good. He was falling forward toward a small scree slope, about to break his leg, or worse. A strong, meaty hand grabbed Panev's flailing arm. It was his father, pulling him back upright before he could do anything beside mildly twist his ankle. It hurt, but he could deal with that. What was a twinge compared to a painful death? He opened his mouth to thank the old man for saving him, but before he could, his father simply nodded and looked away. That was enough. Hello, my friends. Welcome to another episode of Past Lives. I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks so much for being here with me today. A few miles west of the Nile River, near what is today the city of Luxor, and in days long past, the Egyptian capital city of Thebes, lies a dry, dusty valley. Over millions of years, steady rain and torrential storms washed away part of the 1,000-foot-high plateau that forms a portion of the Theban Hills, leaving behind a narrow wadi with a distinctive, almost pyramidal mountain at one end. This mountain is Al-Khur, what ancient Egyptians called Tadkhent, the peak. And for millions of years, it has stared down at the narrow opening in the stacked limestone and sedimentary rock that makes up the valley. For almost 500 years, some of ancient Egypt's most powerful kings made this valley their final resting place. They were laid to rest in chambers cut deep into the living rock, invisible from the surface and filled with the greatest treasures a wealthy, stable society and state could accumulate. Then, once the new kingdom crumbled amid the pressures of the Bronze Age collapse, the tombs were abandoned. Some were robbed, often by the same people responsible for their construction, upkeep, and security. Others were buried by the rampant flash floods that tore through the narrow valley during seasonal rains. A few were simply forgotten altogether. All of them waited nearly 3,000 years to be rediscovered and remembered. The great and majestic necropolis of the millions of years of the pharaoh, life, strength, health in the west of Thebes, as this valley's full name was once known, slipped into the mists of time. Today, this wadi is known, and known well, by a more striking and fitting name, the Valley of the Kings. Over those five centuries I mentioned, between about 1540 and 1075 BC, more than 60 tombs were carved into the limestone of this valley. Hundreds of individuals were buried inside them. Not only kings, but also queens and lower-ranking royal wives, some of the multitudes of children born of the active loins of Egypt's fecund pharaohs, a few high-ranking nobles, at least one royal nurse, and dozens of pets. While most of the tombs were robbed at some point in antiquity, the few undisturbed burials, like that of Tutankhamun, discovered in 1922, show just how rich the grave goods might have been at the time of interment. Each of these constructions was an enormous investment of time, labor, and resources, taking decades to excavate and decorate to the standards expected by Egypt's demanding rulers. As such, these projects could never be left to just anyone. They had to be supervised, funded, and supplied, the kinds of logistics with which the ancient Egyptian state had millennia of practice. A battalion of skilled workers was set to the job, and they kept at it, generation after generation, living out their lives in the purpose-built village set aside for them. We call this place Deir el-Medina, but to the laborers, architects, artists, carpenters, scribes, and administrators who called it home, it was Set Ma'at, the place of truth. Deir el-Medina is one of the best-preserved archaeological sites in the world. We can still see the physical remains of the houses and the tombs where the workers were buried, read the documents they wrote on papyrus and fragments of limestone, and follow their lives in a small, close-knit community. These people were comfortable, but they spent their days far from the elevated circles of the elite that governed their lives. There is nowhere in the ancient world where we can go to know families and individuals from that lower portion of the social hierarchy, that long ago, in so much detail. Today, we'll explore life at Deir el-Medina, even more than Amarna, the short-lived capital of Akhenaten's remade Egypt that we visited in our last episode. Deir el-Medina blesses us with an embarrassment of riches from which to glean information, and therefore understanding, about the lives of its residents. We can walk the route that took them from their village to their job sites in the Valley of the Kings, track the inheritance of a particular house from parent to child, and even follow a laborer as he moved up the career ladder. All of that is compelling enough, but cutting-edge tools and approaches have opened up an entirely new line of inquiry in recent years. Health. I'm not talking about the kinds of traumatic injuries we've observed and discussed in recent episodes, or even the occupational stress markers that habitual activities leave on bone, but actual health, encompassing everything from seasonal illnesses to the networks of care that nursed the sick and cared for the disabled. Because the workers were buried in the nearby cemetery, usually by offspring who themselves lived in Deir el-Medina and followed their parents' occupations, and since those tombs have been systematically excavated, we have a huge sample of human remains from which to work. But since we also have texts, the layout of the village, and so much more, we can build a nearly complete portrait of the physical lives Deir el-Medina's residents lived. Before we dive into this, I want to mention the work of the Egyptologist and bioarchaeologist Anne Austin, who's a professor at the University of Missouri-St. Louis. She's been working in and around Deir el-Medina for years and has done some of the most fascinating research on various aspects of the villagers' lives, but especially in the area of health. I had the great pleasure of interviewing her on Tides of History back in 2022. It's season 4, episode 113, if you want to give it a listen. I'm relying on her various excellent articles and books throughout today's episode. We don't know much about the early years of Deir el-Medina. The oldest evidence from the village dates to the reign of Thutmose I, around 1540 BC, but the villagers themselves revered the slightly later rulers Amenhotep I and his mother, Queen Akhmose Nefertari. For the next two centuries, up until the reign of Akhenaten, the village was increasingly occupied as tombs were constructed in the nearby Valley of the Kings, but we know little about life at Deir el-Medina from that earlier period. What is certain is that the specialist craftspeople who lived there were forced to move to Akhenaten's new capital at Amarna during his reign. Their homes while living at Akhetaten have actually been excavated. It's a small quarter called the Workman's Village. Like Deir el-Medina, it's a tidy, well-planned settlement with one- and two-story houses flanking its ramrod straight streets. Walls protected the settlement from the outside world and kept the tomb builders in. The structure just inside the gate that excavators initially identified as a shrine was more likely a manned guard post. From the perspective of the elites who employed them, their final resting places couldn't be disturbed, and thus, the tomb builders' secrets had to be protected. It's not hard to imagine the villagers' lives in this place. Unlike the downtrodden, impoverished folk who did the unskilled labor at Amarna, they had a strong sense of common identity. They had already begun to call their home village Set Ma'at, the place of truth, and identified themselves as servants in the place of truth. They would have trudged back and forth between Set Ma'at and their nearby worksites, the tombs they were building for Akhenaten and the highest elites of his reforming state, among the cliffs that rose up from the floor of the wadi. From up there, they would have seen the funeral processions regularly hauling the broken, brutalized bodies of Amarna's less respected laborers, our subjects last week, to their shallow graves in the South Tomb Cemetery. It surely occurred to some of these skilled workers that they were lucky to not have to heft limestone blocks or do the other backbreaking tasks that Akhetaten's construction demanded. No matter how difficult their work might have been, and it was hard relative to modern people's expectations of their labor, they could comfort themselves with the knowledge that others were worse off. Soon, they were back at their old home, Deir el-Medina, caught up in the dislocations that accompanied Akhenaten's unexpected death. The latest evidence from the workmen's village at Amarna dates to early in Tutankhamun's reign. After that, like the rest of the site, it was abandoned. At that point, we start to see a great deal more evidence at Deir el-Medina itself. That may be because the workforce was enlarged or reorganized at that time, taking on the form we know well from the site's subsequent heyday. I tend toward the idea that while there had been permanent residents at Deir el-Medina for two centuries, they hadn't been employed solely on projects in the Valley of the Kings, and when they returned from Amarna, the state took a much closer interest in their activities. That would account for why we have so much more documentary evidence from after that point. These were skilled workers, and their services were valued and paid for by state institutions. They received regular and substantial grain rations, fish from the Nile, vegetables, and even pastries. Common laborers paid by the state drew water, brought fuel for the fires, and even handled the laundry. The Egyptian state had a long history, nearly 2,000 years, of practice at this kind of setup. It had been successfully organizing large-scale building projects everywhere from the Sinai to Nubia for centuries. In fact, because so much evidence survives from around Thebes, Deir el-Medina and its environs are the best place in ancient Egypt to see how the state functioned and operated. The short version is, it collected taxes in grain and labor, then redistributed those assets through a series of government offices, the granary, the treasury, the storehouse, and various temples, wherever it needed to go. This was not how most of the non-elite lived in the land of the pharaohs, as the stunted, prematurely aged bodies of the Amarna laborers clearly demonstrate. To the extent that there was something we would call a comfortable middle-class life in ancient Egypt, the residents of Deir el-Medina had it, and it was provided by the state. Ka and Merit were residents of Deir el-Medina, a husband and wife who lived a few decades before the departure for Amarna, during the early period of the village's history. Ka had probably begun his career as a common laborer, but by the time of his death, he had risen to become the overseer of all work at Deir el-Medina. Scholars render his ancient Egyptian title in varying ways as chief architect, director of the royal works, or chief workman. Each of those designations says something about Ka's duties, which included tomb design, managing the workers, and interacting with the officials who oversaw the whole vast project, perhaps even the king himself. To celebrate his success in life, Ka did precisely what a well-off Egyptian was supposed to do. He ordered an elaborate tomb be built for himself in the cemetery just outside his home village. Because of his background in tomb construction, Ka's final resting place drew heavily on what he'd seen and probably built not just for the king, but also the powerful nobility living around Thebes. The funerary chapel took the form of a small pyramid made of mud brick with an exterior coating of white plaster that made it gleam in the sun. A piece of whitewashed sandstone topped the pyramid, elegantly carved with scenes of Ka worshipping the god Ra. Inside the pyramid was a tiny funerary chapel, 10 feet long, 5 feet wide, and 7 feet tall, containing enough space for family members to come and make offerings to the honored dead. The tomb proper was cut into the rock of the cliff just behind the chapel, a space big enough to hold the mummified remains of Ka and Merit and an abundant array of grave goods. This was one of the major transitions occurring throughout the region around Thebes. Single or double burials were being replaced by family tomb complexes, often surmounted by small pyramids that contained multiple burials and still had enough space left over for the living to pay their respects. Ka may in fact have inaugurated this regional trend of larger tombs and chapels, as his are among the earliest to take this form. There's a subtle message built into this shift in burial practices, a movement away from an emphasis on the individual or married couple to the broader social unit, the family. The mummies of Ka and Merit survived the ages in their tomb and have never been unwrapped. X-ray and CT scans tell us much about them, though. Ka was a robust, perhaps somewhat stout, older man in his 50s or 60s. He stood about 5 feet 6 inches tall and had the kinds of mild health problems associated with a long and increasingly prosperous life, including hardened arteries, gallstones, and noticeable degeneration in his lower back. Ka had an old injury to his right elbow where the triceps inserts into the joint, probably caused by overuse performing a repeated task. Holding a chisel in the left hand while hammering with the right is a good candidate, precisely the kind of movement a laborer turned overseer would have happily left behind him as he moved up the ranks. His teeth were in poor shape, the result of a standard Egyptian diet that depended heavily on grain for sustenance. Merit, by contrast, was much younger than her husband, probably aged between 25 and 30, and stood around 5'2" tall. She appears to have been healthy, with no signs of trauma, cancer, or other obvious causes that would have led to her tragically early death. We might infer that her passing was unexpected. The coffin in which she was buried had been inscribed with Ka's name and was originally intended for him. He had clearly spent some time preparing for his death and subsequent interment, while Merit had not. Alternatively, however, we could be seeing the outlines of the blatant gender inequality women dealt with in ancient Egypt. Regardless of the age gap between the couples, a great many women at Deir el-Medina were buried in coffins that hadn't been built for them. Merit, also like most women, was buried with far fewer items of jewelry than her husband. Even if she hadn't died unexpectedly, there may not have been ongoing preparations for her death, unlike her overseer husband. But despite the fact that Merit had fewer grave goods than Ka, she was hardly impoverished. In fact, because the entrance to their tomb proper was covered by a rock slide and inaccessible for millennia, we can see the full panoply with which they were interred, and it's impressive. Copious gilding decorated the multiple coffins and sarcophagi that held their remains. Merit had a gilded funerary mask. Both wore gold earrings, while Ka had additional gold jewelry and funerary amulets. Merit's expensive wig sat in an inscribed wooden box. Still, the sheer volume of Ka's grave goods is overwhelming, and in total cost, they amounted to roughly 5 times the value of Merit's. This was a pattern repeated over and over again at Deir el-Medina, and it speaks to the fundamental gender inequality that would have defined life for women in ancient Egypt. In Ka and Merit's cases, we can simply see that dynamic more clearly because of their relative prosperity. It used to be thought that Ka and Merit weren't properly embalmed after their deaths, since none of the organs had been removed and placed in canopic jars. Recent analysis, however, has proven that wasn't the case. They simply weren't embalmed in the fashion of, or to the standards required by, Egyptian royalty. Chemical analysis of Ka's wrappings indicates that the embalmers treated the linen with a special recipe of animal fat, plant oil, aromatic plant extract, plant gum, and tree resin. Merit's embalmers used a slightly different recipe that included beeswax. Those recipes were chosen for their specific suitability for different layers of wrappings, some of which were more for visual effect, while others were chosen for their preservative qualities. While their embalmers may have used methods unsuitable for kings and queens, this was still a wildly expensive process involving imported ingredients, and it preserved their bodies quite well for more than 3,000 years. The burial of Ka and Merit and the construction of their pyramidal funerary chapel came early during the history of Deir el-Medina. Hundreds upon hundreds of others would live out their lives in that village over the subsequent centuries, leaving their marks in the documentary record, walking the streets, hiking to the Valley of the Kings, arguing with their neighbors over the use of a donkey, and eventually being buried in the nearby cemeteries. But what did it feel like to live at Deir el-Medina on a day-to-day basis? What kinds of aches and pains did people deal with? Were they healthy as we would understand the term? Because of the wonderful preservation of their remains, as well as the considerable written and archaeological evidence from the village, we can go further than anywhere else in the ancient world in answering those questions, to reconstruct the bodily experience of living and working at Deir al-Medina. Luckily, there's a fantastic book by the archaeologist I mentioned earlier, Professor Anne Austin, that was recently published called Healthmaking in Ancient Egypt that focuses on Deir al-Medina. It's the most comprehensive and advanced study of its kind out there for any time or place in the ancient world, a genuine breakthrough in how we can study and understand human health in the past, combining textual and physical evidence side by side on practically every page. This book rules. It should inspire us about the possibilities of new research moving forward, and I am relying on it heavily throughout this next section. By our 21st century standards, life at Deir al-Medina was difficult. The village's location did its inhabitants no favors. It was intentionally chosen for its isolation to prevent the workers from divulging details of their projects to the listening ears of Thebes tomb robbers. The nearest source of water was half a mile away. Surrounded by hills, the breezes that occasionally cool the Valley of the Kings and other nearby wadis never reached Deir al-Medina. In the summer, the temperature soared as high as 130 degrees Fahrenheit. The Valley of the Kings was over a mile away, and most days, regardless of the heat, the workers had to make that journey, clambering up and down slopes with whatever tools and building materials they needed to take with them. This recurring activity left telltale markers on the bones of Deir al-Medina's male residents. A shockingly high proportion of them had osteoarthritis somewhere in their legs, a sure sign of a hard hike done repeatedly. Once they arrived at the Valley of the Kings, their work continued to take a toll. While the limestone of the valley was relatively soft, it still had to be dug out, thousands of tons of rock for each and every tomb. Even the most skilled workers probably got their start doing this most basic task, and everyone would have pitched in as necessary. The skilled work wasn't necessarily easy either. Building scaffolding and doing other necessary bits of craft work like carpentry, carving wall reliefs, hauling materials into the chambers, and doing precise, extraordinarily detailed tasks in cramped, poorly lit conditions was hard. Many, like Ka, would have had sore elbows, a torn rotator cuff that never healed right, or fingers gnarled by decades of holding a paintbrush. Compared to hauling 155-pound limestone blocks at Amarna, the work Ka and those he oversaw were doing was a cakewalk. Compared to a modern-day email job, it was tough. It's fascinating to note, however, that those patterns of degeneration and stress appear only on men and are comparable to most ancient Egyptian populations. The women of Deir al-Medina were far better off than most, more akin in their patterns of degenerative joint disease to Egypt's elite than women living in farming villages. The reason for this was straightforward. Without the occupational stresses of working in the Valley of the Kings, and with state-provided laborers handling the most demanding tasks of drawing and carrying water and hauling fuel, the village's female populace was not nearly as stressed as most Egyptian women. Throughout the Nile Valley, no matter when and where we're looking, women tended to bear more signs of hard work than men. At Deir al-Medina, the pattern was reversed. This points to one of Austin's major insights, that health was about the broad context of the villagers' lives, from birth to death, and encompassed more than trauma and pathogens. Stature provides the first hint. Both men and women in the village were roughly as tall as elite rather than working populations across Egypt. Nobody was as stunted as the impoverished laborers we saw at Amarna. Rates of dental enamel hypoplasias, the thin lines in the tooth enamel that speak to severe episodes of childhood stress and malnutrition, are almost non-existent. Because this was a tight-knit place with ample food resources, even surpluses, the inhabitants simply didn't suffer from those episodes. This is also a sign of the general wellness of Deir al-Medina's women, since maternal and childhood stress are so closely linked. They couldn't avoid malaria or other infectious diseases, however, so we do see cranial porosities, pitted, sponge-like lesions on the skull, with some regularity among the villagers. Traumatic injuries were rare, again, unlike the people buried in the North and South Tomb cemeteries at Amarna, despite spending lifetimes doing work that could easily lead to incidents of harm. The villagers did suffer from hardened arteries and advanced joint degeneration, like Ka did, but that was a function of the fact that they were lucky enough to live to the ages where those issues tend to occur. The 20-somethings who were crushed under limestone blocks in Amarna didn't survive to that point. Not only were the villagers at Deyat and Medina healthier, in terms of lifespan, disease load, nutrition, stature, trauma, and degeneration, than other working populations in ancient Egypt and elsewhere, they were also healthier, in some ways, than Egypt's elites. There was no single reason why this was the case, but it boils down to the fact that beyond a certain point, wealth could not purchase immunity from every potential threat to health and well-being that existed in the Nile Valley. Socioeconomic status mattered insofar as it provided access to nutrition and basic remedies, limiting especially childhood and maternal stressors. Men's work did affect them physically, but unlike many elite males in the New Kingdom, Deyat and Medina's men weren't expected to serve in the military. Sekenen Rattau and the thousands of dead at Kadesh during Ramesses II's reign are good evidence of that, while thousands more surely died prematurely of disease while campaigning in Nubia, Libya, and Syria. Deir al-Medina's male villagers were spared those threats, at least. The overall balance is complicated, and there's no single answer. But if Anne Austin is right, and I think she is, then the major reason why people at Deir al-Medina lived so comparatively well is community. They looked after one another and had a specific phrase they used for the act of caring, which translates, as a command, as, "You shall pay attention to." The villagers recognized something that modern researchers have documented at length, that social support is a massive determinant of health outcomes. In one study, for example, people with stronger social ties were less likely to become symptomatic when exposed to the same infectious dose of the common cold virus. They're less stressed in the most general sense of the term, and less stressed people are hardier. People with higher social support are less likely to develop substance abuse issues. Even believing that one has social support, whether it exists or not, positively correlates with lower mortality. When surrounded by people who care about us, we tend to do better. Deyat and Medina's residents were enmeshed in a dense web of relationships from the moment they were born to the moment they died, and even after. They knew their neighbors and could reasonably expect that their daughters and sons would one day marry each other and have children. As they walked back and forth to the Valley of the Kings, there were folks around to catch them if they slipped and fell on the path, help carry a load when an old back injury flared up, or share some water on a particularly hot day. On many working nights, they stayed at rough dwellings in the Valley of the Kings itself, where they left behind little bits of graffiti. We can easily imagine the workers sitting around a fire on a chilly evening, drinking some thick Egyptian beer, and taking a knife or chisel to the doorframe of their hut. They were companions of eating bread together, as one letter found in the village puts it. Their children played together in the streets and on the nearby hillsides. When they were teenagers, the boys would begin accompanying their fathers to the valley to begin learning their trades. Their spouses, house mistresses or ladies of the house, brought bowls of porridge to sick relatives and wove cloth. Gossiping sometimes brought them trouble, as it often does in small communities. The truly extraordinary craft skills they honed over their lifetimes served their fellow villagers more often than they did their kings. The tombs littering the hills around Deyat and Medina are full of wonderful paintings and beautifully carved wooden objects. The spirits of the many nearby dead haunted them. Restless ghosts were a constant worry. This was generally true throughout the Nile Valley, but it was perhaps heightened among these particular villagers, people whose lives, including their work, revolved around providing for the dead. Still, all things considered, that was a small price to pay for a good, healthy existence, one of the best that could be imagined in all of ancient Egypt. Next time on Past Lives, we'll leave Egypt behind. While the villagers of Deyat and Medina were carving stunning tombs for the New Kingdom pharaohs, the first historical dynasty was rising in what is now China, the Shang, who fueled the advance of both their state and a wealthy group of elites with thousands of human sacrifices. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure to subscribe to our Patreon. It's linked in the description here. The Patreon is only $7 a month, and you get tons of great bonus content like Q&As, interviews with scholars, and much more. It's thanks to subscribers like you that we can make this show. If you're already a subscriber, you rule. And thanks so much. If you haven't checked out my new book, Lost Worlds, you should. It's all about prehistory and what we can learn from the distant past and places like Deyat and Medina. You can follow me on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick or on Blue Sky at Patrick Wyman. Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. The music and sound design is by Gabriel Gould. The story editor is Rachel Cambori. This has been Past Lives.